I'm Frank Vaughn. It's August 11th, 2026, and I got to tell you, some days I don't even know how to put it all together because there's so many competing things that are all true at the same time, and I feel like one of the things that I do or one of the jobs or functions that I'm supposed to serve is putting together a cohesive narrative. It is impossible at this time to do such a thing. So the best we can do is try and highlight some of the points that would form a cohesive narrative if one were to be found. And with that in mind, let's move forward. Now, before any of you catch me in the comments, I know I've criticized other people for trying to formulate narratives. Maybe I shouldn't use the word narrative, but every video should have some kind of theme. And it's hard to pull together a theme. So today we're just going to focus on threads because that's the best we can do. First up, this is... The headline is Cambridge's black time-traveling professor and his many superhuman feats. We're just going to read Jason Ardley's incredible feats aren't just limited to running nearly 240 miles on a fractured leg without medical intervention. He also claimed to have run 600 miles in 6 days on a treadmill without any evidence. Played both football and snooker at a professional level, a boast that was apparently taken out of context, raised over 5.5 million pounds for charity, but can't name a single donor, and managed to go 15 years without barely a wink of sleep, and even appearing on the famous television documentary series 7-Up, which originally premiered a whole 21 years before he was born. This is the story of Cambridge University's youngest ever black professor, who was appointed as professor of sociology of education in 2023. You know, I've known a lot of black people in my life. Believe it or not, I have. Most of them just want to be treated normal. I've known black lawyers. I've known black farmers. I've known black accountants. I've just known black people who live in Canada. And this stuff makes them sick, too. It's like a form of positive racism where the fakest of people are promoted as the poster children for a superhuman Wakanda. And it highlights a problem, actually, that I kind of want to get into, and that is that there is a total lack, as much as I criticize what has been happening on the right, there is a distinct lack of cohesive glue, of rational glue holding together the left at a time when you really need an organized opposition with some better ideas. There are none to be found on the left. Sure, there are some voices that are reasonable, but the left more and more looks a lot like this. This is Corey Morgan, and he is part of the Brain Trust over at the Western Standard. For those of you who may not know about the Western Standard, let me just show it to you. Again, I'm not getting paid to do this. I just think that it's important we have some kind of alternative media. The Western Standard's trying to fill that gap. Here's one of their headlines. Edmonton Police Services scrubbed part of its controversial hate crimes examples amid fierce criticism. EPS began facing backlash on July 31st after the agency made a post on social media that read, "You typed it, someone lived it. Online hate isn't just a comment. It hurts real people and harms real communities. Hate has no home here." And examples of what is hateful is comments like, "Send them back home." Something so innocuous as "send them back home," because why would we be able to express that our country's immigration system is being overwhelmed and our services are being overwhelmed? The road is becoming dangerous because we have non-English speakers who are used to driving in conditions that predominate in India, and they're killing people everywhere. Why would we be able to say, "Send them back home," something innocuous? We have drifted so far from sticks and stones may break my bones. Now words are violence, and we need to go back. We need to turn the dial back on this stuff. But anyway, that's the Western Standard. And this is, well, it's kind of self-explanatory, but this is a video clip of some independence activists out there just trying to get the message out. This idea that people can do better than living under a king with fake charter rights and a parliamentary system that doesn't serve the people. It just serves to elect the government. That's all parliament does. It elects the government. It is not the government. Everything's pre-screened and selected. I've talked about it before. I won't bore you anymore with the details, but just the concept that maybe we could do better, not just as a nation, but as independent sovereign nations breaking the country up to do different things with it. This is the reaction. This is what the left is becoming. Sorry for the language. Okay, that's all you really need to see. I really admire the patience of the people who are suffering under this blistering assault. I don't know if you heard the specific things, but accusing them of assaulting children and saying they need to be deported to Russia, all for the suggestion that maybe there's a better deal to be had for Albertans. And this is, you know, I've often said on this channel that I keep an eye on the Midas Touch Network. God knows I am not one of their subscribers, but I keep an eye on what they say. This is a leftist organization in the United States. And one of the things that they do is they turn people into this. And they do it by constantly regurgitating the same insults and invective and reactions. It's an interesting format that they do because they have like 13 to 17 minute videos. And they'll start with a short segment that's maybe 30 seconds long, which is everything that's in the video. Then they'll expand on it to a 2 or 3 minute segment. Then they'll repeat it again. And all the while, they're hitting with the personal invective and the insults and the demeaning. And this is what the mid-curvers and the low-curvers, which is clearly what this dude is, regardless of who he is, this is what they turn it into. They start to believe that this kind of behavior is okay. It's not just a left-wing problem. The right is doing this too. Every usage of the word libtard is just another loss, as far as I'm concerned, because this needs to be faced with calm, explanatory responses, essentially. You can't compete with this on the level that this guy is coming at you because there's no reasoning with this. You have to exemplify better behavior and better intellectual control than this guy. And I got to say, the people in the video, I mean, he keeps going. Look at him, gimping over there. What's he going to do?
Get out of my fucking country! You fucking scum!
People with long hair, man. As somebody with long hair, there's just so many people who just make bad examples of long hair for everybody. But they're calm. Then he drives his truck right up to them. He thinks he's helping. He thinks he's doing good.
Fuck you, Nazi! Fuck you, Nazi! Fuck you, Nazis!
You can't build anything out of that. And I don't know if I'm effectively highlighting what it is I'm trying to highlight. At a moment when the right, the collective right in the world, in the Western world, is engaged in a geopolitical disaster unlike anything I've seen in my lifetime. I would probably have to go back to the Second World War and the delay of Barbarossa on the part of the Germans and the way that they handled the entire Russian campaign to look at something that was so disastrous for a nation's outcome. I'm not taking sides. I'm just saying, I think what is happening in the Persian Gulf and with Iran is a geopolitical disaster on par with Barbarossa in terms of consequences. It may not lead to as many deaths, though it may lead to many more. But either way, at the time when that is happening, the left is behaving like what we saw in the video clip and does not have a cohesive center. They're able to fling out all kinds of catchphrases and things that they learned in universities where their ideas weren't challenged. They never had to prove their ideas. They never had to subject their ideas to any sort of intellectual rigor. So they got lots of slogans and talking points, but they're very short on detail and vision and self-control. And this is actually one of the things that's been driving me nuts lately is all the copy that's being made about Trump's hair. Trump debuts fourth hair-raising look in 1 week as comb-over transformed by voluminous wigs. We're talking about millions of people making millions of posts for days now about Trump's hair. There's also the issue of whether he's wearing a leg brace or not. I don't believe he is. There's lots of other pictures that can, like, if people were really concerned about his health, and it needs to be said, there's something wrong with the president. He's got bruises all over his arms. He's wearing makeup to cover up what is obviously some kind of IV injection site on his hand. There's something going on. And in a way, the focus on his hair and on his health, and there's all of these videos that are getting 500,000, 1,000,000, 2 million views where they're saying that he is literally soiling himself in the Oval Office. And then they zoom in on people's faces. And every little look is analyzed as though people are reacting to a smell. And millions of people are watching this stuff and engaging with it. I'm just over here like, I'm lost. I think it's just such a waste of time. It's just such petty distraction. Although there is a certain amount of karmic justice, because this is exactly what happened to Biden. In the case of Biden, it was correct. In the case of Trump, on some level, it's going to be correct. But none of this is important. His hair is not important. So while there's this unhinged, reactionary, intellectually bereft thing happening on the left, all while they're engaging with very ultra-socialist government power favorable talking points at a time when in the United States, the Democrat Party is being actively taken over by socialists. They may not take over the whole thing. The Israeli lobby is very strong in the Democrat Party. But it may create an internal division between the radicals and the less radical people in the Democrat Party at a time, come November, when they may assume control of the House and the Senate. It's possible. I don't know what's going to happen, because the American voter is stuck between a rock and a hard place. Do you endorse the president's disaster in the Middle East? Do you endorse the deficit, which is still climbing? Do you endorse the Treasury selling Americans out to back up the yen carry trade so rich people can continue to benefit, so that the rich investment class can continue to have their gains guaranteed by the taxpayer and their losses socialized away, because that's what the Republican Party is doing? Disasters and the same thing they've always been doing. Or do you choose this unhinged Democrat Party that is being infected by raging socialists, or a lighter element of what you might call democratic socialism with an Israeli stamp of approval? Like, what? It's not much of a choice. Let's try to get into some real stuff here. Bessin, the Strait of Hormuz is going to become irrelevant in 2 years. The American theory is, build pipelines in the Middle East, bypass the Strait of Hormuz, and rob the Iranians of their power over 2 years. Although this article doesn't really talk about, or the video, I should say, the interview, doesn't come to the knock-on conclusion, which is you're now starting to get a timeline of 2 years for when the conflict will end. And I say that because if we go to, like I said, this was always going to be a disaster, but I hope you follow along anyway. The Hormuz letter. Iran declares the Strait of Hormuz will stay closed until 2029, the end of Trump's term, unless Trump accepts all of Iran's demand, per a senior Iranian source and Majid Shakiri, advisor to Parliament Speaker Ghalibaf. Iran's demands in the U.S. surrender document remain unchanged. $300 billion in compensation, the release of up to $100 billion in frozen assets, lifting all sanctions, U.S. troop withdrawal from the entire region, an end of the naval blockade, and accepting transit fees on every ship. The Iranians have gone from trying to end the conflict to now their demands are becoming maximal, and they're saying, look, we've been suffering and languishing for decades under sanctions. Suffering is nothing new to us. We'll continue to suffer, and we're pretty sure we can outweigh the United States, because every single day, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve gets lower. Every single day, the American financial position gets worse. I give Bessin credit, because his magic over at the Treasury is delaying the fall off the cliff to keep those stock prices up and to keep commodities down and to keep that yen carry trade going, which is a whole other story I'll try and get into in this video. He's doing some magic, and it's very short-term thinking, and it's working, so I give him credit for that. It's very hedge fundy, but it's going to end catastrophically, and the big money, the whales, look, they're already out, and I'm going to show you that too. But before we get to that, I just want to finish up on this point. These are the global daily Strategic Petroleum Reserve release volumes from February 28th to August 2026. All you need to know is that every single day, There's still millions of barrels of oil coming out of the ground. This is worse in the United States. At the same time as the world desperately needs Hormuz to open up. Remember, what we're talking about is the fact that Bessent is saying it's going to take 2 years to starve Iran out of the Persian Gulf, and the Iranians are saying they're not going to talk to anybody until January of 2029. So we're now moving into a multi-year stalemate. That's the conversation today. I don't think it will remain a stalemate because the war itself is still hot. It's hot in Israel. It's hot with the Yemenis doing a lot of damage to the Saudis. There is now the security partnership between the Turks and the Pakistanis and the Saudis, and they've come out and they've explicitly said that this is a brotherhood alliance, and it's not about targeting or dealing with Muslims fighting Muslims. It is an anti-Western alliance. It's an anti-Israeli alliance. And one of the key architects of that alliance is also in NATO. Once again, as I've said so many times over the years, I have no idea what Turkey is doing in NATO. They should have been kicked out in the 90s. They're nowhere near the North Atlantic. And they are the soft underbelly of NATO, which throws a monkey wrench in everything. They buy Russian military equipment. They buy U.S. They're going to get F-35s at the same time as they're dealing with the Russians. It's a double-dealing nation, which makes sense because it's at the center of the world. But I digress. I want to just highlight quickly Iran's expanding demands. And you can pause and read this. I don't need to go through it. All you need to know is that from March and May to July 7th to today, their demands are getting more maximal. And I said back in March or April, they released a list of demands. And I said then the Americans should agree to it because it's never going to be easier to get out of this war. It only gets harder from here. And I said they were unlikely to do it because it's such a profound loss of prestige and such a damage, a massive amount of damage to Trump's ego and his image of himself. And I mean, you just have to look at how he communicates. He views himself, and you can call it trolling. I don't think it's trolling. He views himself as greater than MacArthur and Patton as this military mastermind. You know, they came up with the blockade. I've spent far too much time the last couple of days arguing in the comments section of several different places where the work will never be seen, trying to make this point in a different way to different people, to different strangers, I suppose, that the blockade itself that the Americans came up with was a way to fool the mid-curvers and the low IQ people who are still on the bandwagon into believing that the United States controls the Strait of Hormuz. How can they say that? Because somewhere out in the Indian Ocean, they've got a blockade. They can't get anywhere near the strait, but since they've got a fence around the block, around the Persian Gulf, the mid-curvers will say the Americans are in control, even though they can't get anywhere near the Persian Gulf, even though it hasn't solved the problem. It's a way for the administration to take credit directly for the disaster they created by handing Iran control of the Persian Gulf in the first place in a war that some idiot in Saskatchewan could predict was going to end up this way. And you know, I still haven't had a single call from any of the influencers I used to talk to saying, you know what, man, you really nailed it. You really nailed that projection that we called you out for and demeaned you for back at the beginning of this war. Man, we're exactly where you thought we would be. Hasn't happened. Just like I haven't had a single apology from anybody who ostracized me for not partaking in the medical experiment. But again, I digress. Now, the week is young, but this is my favorite headline of the last few days. NVIDIA set to reveal record $500 billion off-balance sheet SPV deal to fund the world's biggest circle jerk report. And the reason I love this headline is because the financial media has pretty much given up on this thing. AI and the boom around AI, the thing that is keeping all of these technology companies so inflated and keeping retail playing in the muck like a bunch of idiots while the rich people are gone, is a lot of balance sheet trickery. There is no real money inside the bubble. Now, I'm not saying that AI isn't going to be a critical component of the future. It absolutely is. I don't think data centers are going anywhere. There might be less of them, but I don't believe they're going anywhere. I think the era of free compute is coming to an end, and there's a lot of nuance to it. but it can be a critical component of the future, just like the dot-com bubble. Remember the dot-com bubble? Would anybody argue now that the internet has become less important since the dot-com bubble burst, or more important? The same can be true of AI. There can be a bubble at the same time as it can become a critical component of the future. But what you need to know, if you're swimming in these waters, is simply this. This is the only thing you need to look at. This is Berkshire Hathaway. This is the fund that was founded by Warren Buffett. He's since retired. He's probably still got his fingers in the pool. If they're smart, they're still listening to the guy from a business perspective. This is how much cash they're holding. This was as of March. They are not buying. They're selling. And this is the same story that you can find littered across financial spreadsheets and financial reports all over the world. The smart money is sitting in cash or hard assets waiting. Just waiting. Now, the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. But when you're sitting on over $500 billion, you can probably afford to wait another year or two before things really come unglued. But I don't think it's going to take that long. Bessent's magic isn't going to be able to keep the wheels on the bus for much longer. I do want to talk about the yen carry trade before I get to something that's really important. Yen carry trade blows up. Financial equivalent of all-out nuclear war, Jim Rickards. People should know his name. Most people don't. In simple terms, the problem is people, wealthy people, not you and me, people who have access to central bank money. The problem is people have been borrowing at 0% in yen, Japanese currency, to do deals around the world. So they take that free money and then they pump it into crypto, or they pump it into stocks or pet projects, and the money's basically free. And they can then make yield on that money. They can make percentages on that money. Hell, they could probably stick it in some form of long-term, like some of the online banks have savings accounts that pay upwards of 3.5% or 4% interest, if you know what you're looking for. And you could profitably stick your borrowed yen, convert it to the currency of your choice, stick it in a high-yield investment, and just pocket the difference. And never pay it back. Just make payments on the servicing. Anyway, everything was fine until interest rates in Japan started going up after more than two decades. I'm just going to read Rickards for a minute. Rickards says, "This is the engine of global economic growth. It has been powering the U.S. economy and the global economy for over 30 years, over a generation, most of my adult life. I mean, you go back 30 years, I'm 16 years old. I ain't paying attention to nothing. So we grew up in this environment. This is what we are. This is what the people who are working and being productive and paying taxes, which I am among them, this is the world we grew up in. Cheap money." Not the entire way. There's some caveats there, but what could go wrong? The thing that could go wrong the fastest is if Japanese interest rates went up. The Bank of Japan says it's going to keep raising rates. It's not going to the moon, but 3% for yen is like going to the moon when it's been 0% for 20 years. And so now, the yen carry trade is unwinding. The original borrower borrows dollars to pay back the yen loan, swaps the yen and pays back the yen loan, swaps to yen, then pays back the yen more. What if you can't borrow? What if the bank says, sorry, no soup for you? Now what do you do if you want to get out of your yen carry trade? You have to sell assets. So you are going to sit there and make a lot less money and even lose money, or you're going to dump assets to get dollars to pay back the yen loan. They're both bad for the markets. If you have to sell assets, guess what? The price goes down and other people have to sell assets. Next thing you know, it's a stampede. Everyone is running to the exits. This is not a few investment banks on Wall Street or a few hedge funds. This is the whole thing, the whole world, getting out of the leveraged exchange rate system. This is the financial equivalent of an all-out nuclear war. It's true, and this is why the Treasury is backstopping the yen for now. And this comes in at the second paragraph that I'm going to read. Japan is the number one holder of U.S. treasuries. They have been selling treasuries to get dollars to buy yen to prop up the yen. What happens when you sell treasuries? U.S. interest rates go up. Do you think the Trump administration or the Secretary of Treasury wants U.S. interest rates to go up? You're already spending one out of every five tax dollars just on financing the debt. The United States is broke. I still see today, again, I know I've complained about this recently, but the comparisons between one nation's lot in the West and another nation's lot in the West. Comparisons between Canada and the United States, as though those comparisons matter. The entire bloody plane is crashing. Japan is part of that crash. And they're using financial trickery to delay, all the while, remember, Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on $500 billion. It's all you really need to know. They're out of equities. The whales have led retail once again into the market, and retail is going to get wrecked. That's what happens every single time. Treasury Secretary, what happened to my mouse? Treasury Secretary Bessent called Japan and said, hold on to your treasury. Don't sell those. You're killing us. We'll give you all the dollars you need with a swap line with the Federal Reserve. So the Fed will print and give it right to Japan. Remember, when the Fed prints, they rob every single American by inflating the money supply. The Trump administration was elected to halt inflation. But Bessent is engaging in another inflationary measure to try and keep the wheels on the bus. We'll give you all the dollars you need with a swap line to the Federal Reserve. So what we are doing in the U.S. is using dollars from the Fed to prop up the yen so the Japanese do not have to raise interest rates, so the carry trade does not unwind, so the markets don't collapse. It's extremely dangerous. You're trying to defend an exchange rate that can't be defended. He says probably. No, it can't be defended. And it's just a matter of time before it breaks. The world's been trying to break for a very long time, but we're running out of runway for halting it through financial trickery. Reality is knocking at the door. The fake paper price of everything is going to, it's going to unwind, and it's going to unwind in a major way, and it's going to hurt a lot of people. And with that in mind, we keep reading about terrorist attacks, cyber attacks from Iran. Iran suspected multi-state water system attacks widen. I don't know if it's Iran. I don't know if it's Israel. I don't know who it is. And I'll be honest, I don't care, because there's a much bigger water problem happening. Southwest reservoirs reach record low levels. What is World Team doing talking about the most important story in the United States South right now that is not being covered sufficiently, in my opinion, by anybody? Not by the financial media, not by the science media, not by the news media. It kind of goes along with the fact that, have you noticed a decline and fall in instances of the financial media reporting the ships that are being struck by drones in the Middle East every single day, in the Persian Gulf every single day? They don't even talk about it anymore. It's just such bad news, they're just burying their head in the sand. It's kind of like Trump. Actually, before we talk about this very real and serious problem, let's go to this tweet, which nobody cares about. It's one of the most important tweets, and nobody cares about it. Trump says, we're low-keying it. A war of aggression the United States started, which literally set a dozen countries on fire. It is a regional war. It stretches from the fields of Ukraine all the way to the Gulf of Aden to the Persian Gulf. The whole thing's on fire. And he's saying, we're low-keying it. We're just not going to talk about it. He's hiding from it. He's out there golfing, tweeting AI photos of himself, which, by the way, you take the AI photo of him and Gary Player, and you feed it to Grok, and you ask Grok over and over again, is this image AI? And Grok will sit there and gaslight you and tell you it is not AI. It is 100% authentic because Trump posted it. We know where X is. We know where Grok is. I wish I had canceled my subscription before it renewed, because there's no way to get my money back now, so I'm stuck with it. The other thing is the marvelous strategic philosophy that the Trump administration is deploying. It's called, it always works out. Somehow it always works out. I've heard him say this phrase multiple times. When he's facing tough questions, he's like, I don't think about it. It just has a way of working itself out. I can point to half a dozen world leaders off the top of my head throughout the course of history who deployed this reason, and I can tell you how it worked out for them. Also, this phrase, we're semi-negotiating. What does that even mean? But anyway, let's just get back to something important. Southwest reservoirs reach record low levels. We're talking about Lake Powell. We're talking about Lake Mead. Really important. And we'll just go to this. Hoover Dam is losing power inside the slowest moving train wreck in history. This is Popular Mechanics, for heaven's sake, reposted on MSN. At least they covered it. This should be near the top of the list I've been following this story for years. From the rim of Lake Powell, you can't see the danger line. There isn't a flashing gauge or a chart on the canyon wall that warns visitors when one of the most important machines in America is going to fail. There's only an invisible number, 3,490 feet above sea levels. Engineers call it minimum power pool. Above that elevation, Lake Powell can still push water through Glen Canyon Dam's massive penstocks, spin its turbines, and send electricity across the southwest with no trouble. Below it, the dam loses the function that helped justify its existence. The river still wants to move, but the machine starts running out of ways to move it. I got to tell you, I have been praying, literally, at various times for years now, that the weather would turn and just soak the southwest and refill these reservoirs, because the humanitarian crisis the failure of these reservoirs is going to cause, and by failure, I mean they're just going to run out of water, it's going to be beyond the imagination. Like, no, nobody is prepared for it. Nobody seems to be thinking about it, and it's such a big problem that everybody's afraid to examine it. And if you're a Canadian, and you're sitting up here with our gads of fresh water, you should probably be paying attention to this story 2,000 or 3,000 miles to your south. Because our water is going to become a key geopolitical survival resource. And there's no quick way to get it down there. But you can bet your bottom dollar when tens of millions of people lose their power, and when the drinking water of tens of millions is threatened directly, they're going to get it from somewhere. This is one of the things that I prefer people focused on rather than Trump's wigs, rather than whether or not he's wearing a leg brace when he's not. If you ask me, because the pictures that show him bending weird looks like back pain to me. The dude's 80 years old. He's going to have some problems. There's very few people who are at the peak of their health at 80 years old. But I digress. It's such a pointless thing, because there's so many real unfolding disasters that require the attention of leadership and those who want to be in leadership. They should have plans for these things. They should be approaching these things. And instead, they're talking about superficialities, or they're engaged in sloganeering, or they're just pretending the problems don't exist. It feels like no matter what you do at this time, the ship doesn't have a captain. Or it doesn't have a captain that is in possession of all of the rational faculties to navigate all of the many icebergs that lie ahead. Whether you're American, whether you're Canadian, whether you're Iranian, whether you're European. We're talking about Lake Mead. We're talking about Lake Powell. We're talking about the drought in the southwest. But look at what's happening to Europe. They're experiencing a disaster. Shipping is grinding to a halt because the rivers are so low, and crop failure is inevitable. So we have a year that's already baked in the fertilizer shortage. It's August. I stopped talking about this because I was talking about it back in April and May, how I was worried about the planting season. I got to say, where I live, the crops look great for the most part, but that's not the same story over the rest of the planet. The people who got shortchanged on fertilizer live in countries nobody cares about. Just brown people in the third world. No one cares about that. But European crop failures, the loss of Odessa to the Ukrainians, can they even get their crops to market? We've got attacks on petrochemical facilities all over the world, creating an energy crisis. We've got the shutdown of the Persian Gulf. And I think people are married to magical thinking that there is some sort of brilliant plan. There's some kind of 5D chess game being played out there, and it's all going to magically work out. But I'm here to tell you, you don't have a lot of time left to make yourself more resilient. Make yourself able to just sit at home, light a fire, and watch the world go by for the next several years, because it's going to get super dicey. And I think you want to be in a position to be as far away from the people in that Corey Morgan video. That guy who's yelling, screaming fascist, calling people Nazis because they just want to pursue a better deal for their province. That guy has no clue what's coming. He's gimping around on his cane. He's probably sitting on a couple different pensions. That's what enables him to have such a loud mouth. That pension income is going to keep coming in. He takes it for granted. Most people do. I saw a video the other day. I told you this video was going to be all over the place. I saw a video the other day, and it was a bunch of liberal door knockers. I believe it was in Victoria, going out door knocking, and they were singing a very cheesy song, trying to get their person elected in a by-election. And it's all boomers, it's all pensioners, and they're all out there door knocking, and they have no idea that the people they're defending are going to rob them of their stipend. What they think they paid into their entire life. Pensioners are... I'll finish up with this, because like I could probably do a three-hour video today, but I hate to say this to people because it sounds kind of scary, because it kind of is. People don't want to be scared. But if you want an allegory for where we're headed, you just need to look at the Soviet Union in the 1990s. Did people get to keep their pensions? Sure. But those pensions couldn't buy anything. I'm Frank Fong. I'll see you in the next one.